You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more Americans than ever before are working from home at least part of the time. We'll look at that trend, and you can share your experiences. Now, a second whistleblower is sharing concerns about President Trump's interactions with Ukraine, according to a lawyer for the first whistleblower. Over the last few days, Republican senators have been responding to the ongoing story and to impeachment efforts in the House. Some, including Senators Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Ben Sasse, and Rob Portman, have shared at least some level of concern with the president's actions. Last week, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson said a top U.S. diplomat told him military aid to Ukraine had been withheld by Trump in exchange for a promise to advance the investigations he was asking for. Johnson went on to say that the president denied this was the case when he spoke to him directly. The senator has continued to defend the president's actions last week and over the weekend. We have an invitation out to Senator Johnson to join us on the Ideas Network to talk about impeachment efforts. Now, Molly Beck is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter covering state politics and government. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of attention on Republican senators in general. Can you tell us what put Senator Johnson in the limelight over the last week or so?
So Senator Ron Johnson has been part of a caucus within the U.S. Senate that goes to Ukraine quite a bit and focuses on issues related to Ukraine. And so he has an interest in what's going on there. And he revealed to reporters last week that he was told about the allegation that everyone's heard now that President Trump had allegedly withheld U.S. aid until Ukrainian officials had investigated either 2016 meddling or his current political rival, Joe Biden. Senator Johnson said that he asked the president when he heard that allegation if he could tell Ukraine, don't worry, the aid's coming, and the president said no.
And Senator Johnson had heard this, he said, from Gordon Sondland, then U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who he says shared this information with him. This was, and again, this is a few weeks before this, as you said, all came out to the public. This was kind of a big bombshell, right?
Right. And Senator Johnson saying that, you know, he heard this allegation before the public did, and he went straight to the president to see if it was true or not. And by revealing that to the public, he's kind of giving credence to some of what the House Democrats are looking at. They're saying that this is an allegation, this is true. The president's obviously saying he didn't do that. But the fact that, you know, Senator Johnson heard about it is what's interesting here.
And Senator Johnson has said different things about the concept of asking a foreign government, the president asking a foreign government to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden. Can you run through some of the other statements apart from the one that he shared with The Wall Street Journal?
Right. So Ron Johnson said that what he believes happened is that the president wants Ukrainian officials to look into whether the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign had any involvement with Ukraine trying to look into the president's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. So there's, you know, a lot of people believe that this call for an investigation is about Joe Biden, and Senator Johnson disputes that and says it's about 2016, which is a different thing altogether.
Now, Senator Johnson then was on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd over the weekend. This has gotten a lot of play since then. Mm-hmm. Johnson was asked by Chuck Todd about why he winced, as Senator Johnson described it, when he heard this possible connection between military aid to Ukraine and this kind of investigation. That was the first question, and then Senator Johnson moved on into an explanation of why he thought the president's supporters were upset. Here's a little bit about the contentious back and forth.
Okay, this is not about the media. Senator Johnson, Senator Johnson, please, can we please answer the question that I asked you instead of trying to make Donald Trump feel better here that you're not criticizing him?
I'm just trying to ask you a simple question of what made you wince.
I'm asking a simple question about you. Clearly, were upset that somehow there was an implication that military aid was being frozen because the president wanted an investigation. Why did you wince?
Because I didn't want those connected.
And I was supporting the aide, as is Senator Murphy, as is everybody that went to that initial inauguration.
So this is a heck of an interview for whoever had to transcribe it. Molly, what do you make of this contentious interview?
Yeah, if you talk to Democrats and critics of Senator Johnson, they would say that that interview was about Senator Johnson trying to show the president that he was still supportive of him, because last week his revealing of his discussion with the president about the aide and that he didn't want that aide tied to any kind of investigation into a political rival was seen by some as, you know, helping out the impeachment inquiry. But Senator Johnson obviously would say that he, you know, what's being reported is not characterized correctly by reporters or by Democrats. And he was, you know, pretty passionate about that, as you heard.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson in the spotlight over issues related to impeachment. Molly, I saw Ron Johnson's office had released a brief statement saying, hey, here's the transcript. Chuck Todd kept talking over the senator. Here's what really happened. So Senator Johnson from day to day is working on advancing the narrative he wants to advance, it sounds like.
Yeah, I just saw that too. He transcribed the whole thing just like we had to do. So it sounds like he's not, you know, trying to walk away from that.
Now, what are some of the next questions you're looking at in your reporting on Senator Johnson and his statements, his activities related to the impeachment?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously interested in his role or his place in this whole impeachment issue and inquiry, because he seems to have a unique connection or relationship with the president on these issues that they're talking about. And my questions I have are, you know, what did the senator do with this information when he heard it? Did he just go to the president, or did he talk to other people? What is the protocol for that, if there is any? You know, obviously this hasn't happened before and that I know of, so maybe there's not a protocol, but those are the kind of questions we're looking at.
And it's fairly rare, it seems like, that members of our Wisconsin congressional delegation end up kind of in the hot seat the way Senator Johnson has been over the last week. That's drawing attention of a lot of Wisconsin reporters like you and your colleagues there.
Right. Yeah, it's been fun to try to catch up with the national reporters, that's for sure.
We'll leave it there. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck, state politics and government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with her today about comments from Senator Ron Johnson about President Trump and his communication with Ukraine that's sparked a formal impeachment inquiry. We have invitations out to Senator Johnson and many other members of the Wisconsin congressional delegation to talk about issues related to impeachment, either here on the Central Time or on the morning show. Congressman Mark Pocan will join the morning show tomorrow morning, I believe at 6:30, 7 o'clock. Check me on that. I'll fill you in later. Coming up, we'll find out how researchers are using technology to gather new information about Wisconsin's state fish, the muskie. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll find out about a project coming up that monitors Wisconsin's muskie population. It's about halfway through a 20-year study. And by the way, you can help. You can be a citizen scientist and help out the Wisconsin DNR. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic food stand in southwest Wisconsin.
Pete's Hamburger Stand in Prairie du Chien hit a milestone this year, 110 years in business. Not only have multiple generations of families been enjoying these burgers on the weekends for more than a century, but generations of Pete's descendants have been flipping burgers, grilling onions, and running the stand during that time. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently visited Pete's to find out what makes the burgers so special.
All right, and two burgers and a drink will be $10.25.
When you step up to order at Pete's Hamburger Stand, you'll notice there's only four things on the menu: soda, water, chips, and a hamburger.
Have a nice day.
You too.
Hi.
And the recipe is simple. Quality ground beef, onions, a little salt. Oh, and water? For generations, regulars have been lining up for their beloved hamburgers at Pete's. Just listen to a few of them.
They're good.
Kind of like a White Castle, but a bigger White Castle. Definitely more meat. It's good. Love them.
They're unique and different and healthy.
Nobody can beat them.
Try it once.
The stand in downtown Prairie du Chien looks like it's straight out of the 1920s. It's tiny, with green and white awning and sliding windows you walk up to place your order. And inside is Pete's granddaughter, cooking the burgers exactly the way he did more than a century ago.
My name is Mary Hoosier. I am the granddaughter of Pete Gokey, the founder of Pete's Hamburger Stand. We're 110 years old this season.
Locals say it's the best burger around. On the day I stopped by, almost as soon as the sign flipped to open, there was a line. So what keeps people coming back?
The water keeps the burgers nice and moist. Our pan doesn't have a drain in it, so we don't clean it till the end of the day. We just keep adding water and onions and meat all day, and it just makes for a good recipe.
Mary's husband, Bill Hoosier, also cooks at the stand. He says each burger leaves behind a little more flavor as it cooks.
It gets better. A lot of people won't eat off the first pan. They claim it doesn't taste as good. So.
Before Pete's became a permanent stand in the 1920s, the original Pete, who was also a volunteer firefighter, sold his burgers from a cart at festivals and fairs. He noticed the burgers stayed juicy when he cooked them in water as the customers ebbed and flowed. The recipe hasn't changed since.
One? Onions on it? Nope? Okay.
Today, the stand, which is open Friday through Sunday, goes through a couple hundred pounds of meat each day and up to 500 pounds of onions over the weekend. Mary cooks anywhere from 55 to 65 burgers at a time. And while that might sound like a lot, they were gone in a flash the day I visited.
What's it like to be cooking hamburgers when you stay that long?
Well, on some days, it's all right if the weather is cool. On hot days, it can be very exhausting. By the end of your shift, you are ready to go home.
But Mary and Bill say there's something special about having to wait in line to get your burger.
Coming to a stand like this where you have to wait probably, and it's something most people are not used to, or not anymore at least, and it's kind of nostalgic. And people talk in line when they're standing waiting, and it's amazing the connections that they can find, you know, between people that are usually strangers. And sometimes they aren't when they leave here, so that's kind of neat.
The Hoosiers are big on community, not only in how they source their products with local meat and buns, but they also donate all proceeds from their bag chip sales to people in the community fighting cancer. Bill and Mary say hard work, perseverance, and a quality product are what have kept the business going for so long. As for what the original Pete might think about making it 110 years,
I think he'd be very proud of his children and grandchildren.
So whether you like your burgers with onions or without, just don't ask for cheese. The Hoosiers hope you'll enjoy the burgers and meet some new friends along the way.
Well, I just hope that they come here and they get their money's worth. You know, they feel that they've gotten the product that's worth what they've paid for, and they've gotten good service. And hopefully along the way, the environment added to it just makes it fun, even if you have to stand in line.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy is a digital content producer and brought us that story on Pete's Hamburgers, which has been open in Prairie du Chien for 110 years. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, fishery biologists at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources are halfway through a 20-year project to learn more about our state fish, the muskellunge, or muskie. They're using some common technology to track how old the fish get and how quickly they grow to the 3 or more feet that's common for the species. Greg Sass is the fisheries research team leader in the Office of Applied Science with the Wisconsin DNR. He's based at the Northern Highland Fishery Research Area in Boulder Junction. He recently spoke with Centertime producer Dean Knetter.
First off, can you tell us a bit about what makes the muskie a unique fish and one that you wanted to do a closer study of?
Sure. Well, as you may know, it's Wisconsin state fish, so that makes it quite important in itself. But it's a very charismatic and somewhat elusive species, as many of the muskie anglers will tell you, often called the fish of 10,000 casts. But, you know, it's a large fish growing to over 40 pounds and greater than 50 inches, and just tremendous sport fish as far as its fight and, again, its elusive nature. And so it's also a species that most anglers now are releasing, and so it makes it more difficult to get some of the information we need from fish, such as their growth rate or how old they are, because we can get those things that we need from the fish populations or the fish species in a lot of ways through destructive means, through an inner ear bone called the otolith, but Again, since we don't want to harvest muskies and most anglers aren't, it's difficult to get that information. So the study is really designed to provide us with that information by non-harvesting means.
Could you tell us a bit more about this project you and your team are working on? How are you going about monitoring the age and size of muskies?
Sure. It's a great question. And so really the basis of the project is that we've put a pretty large-scale effort to implant passive integrated transponder tags into some of our hatchery muskies that we've raised in Spooner at our Governor Thompson hatchery there. So this is one of the larger hatcheries that we have within the state. And so the hatchery raises these fish into the fall when they're anywhere between 10 and 12 inches long. And we've gone in and implanted these tags within these young year hatchery raised muskies and then gone out and released them in several of our study lakes. And now that we have those known age young year hatchery fish in these lakes, if we continue to monitor those lakes over time and recapture those individuals, because we knew when we stocked them and how long they were at that time and what age they were, when we recapture them later on in our surveys, or if anglers or guides that we've enlisted to help us with this study capture those fish, we can scan those fish for that individually numbered pit tag that's implanted, also take its length so we can know 3 years later it was this long, if we capture it 12 years later it was this long. And so it gives us that critical information on the known age and length of muskie in our northern Wisconsin lakes.
And how do you go about actually implanting these chips in the fingerling muskies?
Another great question. Again, a pit tag is the same thing we might call a microchip that we put in our pets. And so really all it is a small syringe that holds this pit tag. It's about the size of a grain of rice, and it's implanted into the abdominal cavity, and there it'll stay, and it'll stay throughout the lifespan of the fish. And that tag only gets activated when we run a wand over it. And so we run the wand over the abdomen of a fish that we recapture later on, and if that tag is in there, it'll be activated and that number shows up on the screen and we can record it along with the length and the length of the fish, and we know what the age is because of when it was stocked out in that fishery or in that lake.
Greg, in terms of muskie populations generally, do we know if they stay pretty stable or do we see swings in their numbers over time?
In general, they stay pretty stable. And again, that's an interesting question. Some of our collaborators at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point have actually addressed this question over the past couple of years by doing population estimates on individual lakes for muskies a number of years in a row to see how consistent that adult population stays. And in general, that stability is observed for anywhere up to 5 years, sometimes a bit longer depending on the population. And so what it tells us is that natural mortality rates of muskie are pretty low in those adult populations, and that especially is aided by the fact that most anglers catch and release muskies when they capture them and are using good handling techniques throughout the fighting process when they're taking the hooks out and then releasing those fish back into the water. So quite stable over time.
We're talking to Greg Sass right now, the fisheries research team leader in the Office of Applied Science with the Wisconsin DNR, looking at a project he and his team are doing in northwestern Wisconsin using microchips to track the age and size of muskies. And Greg, why is this data that you're gathering so important?
It's critical in our management of muskie populations and better understanding their population dynamics. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of the things that we need from fish can be collected from more destructive means, you know, having to sacrifice the fish in order to get the information. In this case, we're using novel techniques to get the sorts of parameters that we need to better manage fisheries. And in many cases, that's things like how long the fish are, how much they weigh, and what their age is. And so what we're doing here gives us critical information to understand the status of our muskie populations in northern Wisconsin, how to best manage those populations. And in addition to that, it also gives us an idea using these pit tags about our stocking success. So how many of the fish are we stocking are surviving? What's an optimal stocking rate for muskie? And so it helps us get the right number of fish out there on the landscape to support and sustain these fisheries, but also creates efficiencies within the agency as well, whereas sometimes stocking more isn't better, and so we can find that optimum. So this study is really aimed to give us some good critical information that we've never had on muskie populations in Wisconsin before.
And as we wrap up, is this something that people can get involved with if they're interested in helping out?
Yeah, we've worked with a lot of the guides and some of the muskie angler groups in Northwest Wisconsin. They've been tremendously helpful to us. Like Muskies Inc., for example, and some of the guides, they've actually used some of their money to buy pit tag readers so that they can go out. The guides can take those pit tag readers, take the clients out. If they catch muskies where we might have pit tags in that population, they can scan them. And they've been absolutely amazing at getting us that information. I believe about 11% of all of our recaptures of pit tags have come from anglers with guides and resort owners where we've given them these pit tag readers to send out with their clients. And so we're encouraging and continuing to work with resorts and guides and other individuals to help us with this project, because it's a tremendous way to engage in citizen science where we have a very passionate and dedicated angling group from Muskie that can now get directly involved with fisheries research within the state of Wisconsin.
Interesting stuff. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Greg Sass is the Fisheries Research Team Leader in the Office of Applied Science with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He recently talked to Central Time producer Dean Knetter about their 20-year project to monitor the state's muskie population by implanting microchips in the juvenile fish. Coming up, new data from the U.S. Department of Labor shows that more Americans are working from home at least some of the time. We'll find out what that might mean for workers and for employers. And we want to hear from you. You can get us started right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you work from home all the time, some of the time? If you're an employer, do you are you able to let your workers work from home? How does that work out for you? If you can't work from home, do you wish you could? Or if you do, the other way around, do you not like it? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That conversation coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes Representative Mark Pocan for a look at the latest stories in national news, including the latest on impeachment efforts in the U.S. House. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Department of Labor, in 2017 and 2018, about a quarter of U.S. workers worked from home at least some of the work week. That's up from 19% in 2003 when they first started tracking it. We wanted to find out what's behind those numbers and what they might mean for workers and employers, and you can share your experiences working from home or employing people who do. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Patricia Mullins is Professor Emerita in the School of Business at UW-Madison. She's author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. Patty, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We see these numbers of people working at home, at least some of the time, inching upward over time. Why do you think that is?
I think it's primarily because the workplace is changing. There are a lot more work jobs that are compatible with being able to work at home, or telecommute, as they call it. It's estimated now that over 50% of jobs are at least compatible in some way with at least one day of work at home.
And I remember not that long ago, it seemed like this was the wave of the future. We were going to see huge, fast increases in the number of people working at home. And again, it's going up steadily, but not quickly. So what might be holding employers in particular back from wanting to have people work from home?
I think sometimes employers are worried about productivity, and they're worried that people are not going to be as productive if they're working at home. Although most studies have shown that productivity increases, satisfaction increases, workers are retained for a longer time. You can get much more talented people because you can get someone who's not in your local area.
Now, obviously, some jobs you got to be there. If you're a wait staff at a restaurant, you can't do that from home. That said, do we have a sense of the kinds of jobs that tend to lend themselves more to telecommuting?
Mostly management, financial jobs, business jobs. But there are some that are unusual. When I saw a ranking recently of the jobs, some of them are analysts, some are military jobs. Even doctors, radiologists, for example, are starting to work from home. Because they're reading x-rays, so they can do that at home. One of the things I think that's interesting when we're talking about working at home is there are people who have always worked at home. We think about teachers. We don't know many teachers who don't bring work home. Grading papers, preparing lesson plans. Salespeople, sales representatives have probably always worked at home on the telephone. It's just now with the advent of our new technology, we can do a lot more different kinds of jobs at home.
Well, and that reminds me, the study said that about 1 in 5 of the people who were working at home occasionally, said they weren't getting paid for it. It was, in effect, extra time at home devoted to work, like the teacher bringing the homework home.
Exactly. And I think we find that a lot in the managerial area. If someone's doing if they're managing people, they have to be there. But if they have to do job performance evaluations and write them up, that's a good day to work at home because then you're not interrupted. You can have your quiet time and finish all your writing at that point.
Now, this is running against another strain, I think, in the work world that's coming from Silicon Valley that says you want your workers from different lines of work bumping into each other, interacting in the break room, in the hallway, walking through the office, and that sparks discussions and that leads to creative problem solving. Is that a real thing, and is it getting lost if more of us are working at home?
I think it is a real thing, and you have to be a certain kind of worker to want to work at home. Most businesses, large businesses like Dell, Aetna, Xerox, they have a significant proportion of their workforce working at home, but they screen them very carefully. You have to be extremely motivated. You have to have a good space to be able to work, and you have to have, again, a job that's compatible. And your employer has to have reasonable expectations so that you know exactly what you have to accomplish. Otherwise, it won't necessarily be successful. Typically, the person who's working at home is older because younger people do like that, you know, non-isolating. You're more isolated when you're working at home. They like that energy and they like that enthusiasm. If you're in a creative kind of situation, it may not be good for you to be working in isolation unless you do a lot of interaction on FaceTime and have those kinds of interactions. But it's still not the same as bumping into someone at the water cooler.
Talking to Patricia Mullins from the UW-Madison School of Business, author of the book The Best Work of Your Life, talking about new federal data on people working at home. It's been going up over time. About a quarter of people say they work from home at least some of the time. And this is part of a wider interest in the idea of workplace flexibility, this ability to work at home is a subset of that. There's also talk about letting people choose their hours as long as they get all necessary hours in. Is that also a trend you're seeing, just efforts at more flexibility?
For sure, yes. I think that workplace flexibility is increasing. It satisfies more people who are interested in work-life balance. It satisfies families, not just men, not just women, but also men. And that's an interesting part, I think, of these data, is that the people who work at home tend to be equal on gender. You know, males and females tend to work at home about equally, but for different reasons. Women say their reason more is to take care of personal and family events, and men say they just like having the personal time to work alone.
That's men and women coming out pretty evenly on that. Do we know anything else about demographics as far as things like ethnicity and income levels?
Yes, we know that gender is about equal, but we know that people who are of color do not work at home as much as the white working population. We know that they tend to be educated. We know that they tend to be older, and they tend to earn on average, about $4,000 more a year, those workers who are working at home.
Talking about flexibility, this report did find some people at the other end of things. They asked a question about how long in advance do you get your schedule for a particular week? And a lot of people, it might be a month, or you always know because it's always the same thing. But there's a decent percentage in the teens, I think it was, where people found out the week before or less than a week before. Who is that hitting?
Right. I think that's hitting a lot of people where the workplace is in flux. Things like long distance hauling, driving, extraction, businesses, those kinds of things where it's a little more unpredictable, things that depend on the weather. Also, things like restaurants. We know that staffing depends on what's happening in the local area. If there's a football game or if there's a local high school prom, things are going to be busier. So those kinds of jobs tend to be less predictable.
Here's an interesting case study going on. The state of Utah apparently is in the midst of this interesting experiment on productivity. They're randomly assigning, if I have this right, state workers to work from home and then seeing how it works out, I guess. What are they learning so far?
Yeah, so far they've found 20% increase in productivity and that people are a lot happier if they enjoy the working at home, right? Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, for some people it's just not their thing. I read some of the follow-up comments to this survey, and one person said, I'd weigh 600 pounds and I would be fighting with my neighbors all the time if I worked at home. Mm-hmm. It's just not me. So that's why it's important to consider, is that really for you? Are you the kind of person who's going to be motivated and who's going to get up and, you don't have to get out of your jammies, but you do have to get to work?
I think I would probably lose weight. A lot of donuts and things like that tend to show up here at my workplace. You mentioned earlier that radiologist who might be able to work remotely. Can you talk about the role of changing technology? Because, not that long ago, if you'd wanted that much data, you would have had to drive to the hospital, get it, and drive it back home. We're in new frontiers with the ability to telecommute.
Right, right. And now we can do that in so many different ways. 3D, virtual reality. We can, as you said, a radiologist can have the x-rays up on his screen in his home office or her home office. A lot of physicians now will do their consulting if they're doing write-ups and things in their home office. So in a way, we can get a lot more done because we have access with the new technology.
And some of the officials in Utah have said, hey, this could end up being a boon for rural communities. And we talk about that idea, having rural broadband could allow more people to telecommute. That could allow more people to move to and then spend money in rural communities that need that kind of economic activity.
Right. And what we find is it's interesting. There's one piece of data that shows that the states that have the most people who are working from home are the states that have lots of outdoor recreation, like Maine, Vermont, Oregon, Utah, Montana. Those are the areas where it's highest because then there was one article I read about a guy who moved from Washington, D.C. to the northern Minnesota because he could have a better life for his family. So, if you're going to choose to be able to work at home and you can be anywhere, it is a boon for those kinds of communities.
We're talking to Patricia Mullins right now, professor emerita in the School of Business at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. We're looking at new data from the U.S. Department of Labor that shows about one quarter of American workers work from home at least some of the time. That has been creeping up over the last 15, 20 years or so. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have the option to work from home? If you do, do you like it or do you prefer to be in a workplace with your colleagues? If you don't have the option to work from home, do you wish you could? And if you employ people, if you're a manager or business owner, are you able to let people work from home? How does it work out for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the overall growing number of American workers who are working from home at least some of the work week. Patricia Mullins stays with us. She's a professor emerita in the School of Business at UW-Madison and author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work from home? Have you ever? If you don't, would you want to? Love to hear about your experiences. Are you able to get stuff done working at home, or is it hard to motivate yourself? And if you're an employer who offers this option, how does that work for your business? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Patty, it seems like not that long ago, there was kind of a pushback where some of the technology companies in particular said, yeah, we're gonna be on the frontiers of letting people work at home. We're dialing it back in. Why is that?
Well, I think they found that sometimes the creativity is lacking. And I think the sweet spot people have found now, it's 2 to 3 days a week of working at home and then having some in-office time. Now, that's very difficult if you have an expert on your staff who happens to be, you know, 500 miles away from you. But businesses are realizing it's not just a nice thing to do for workers. They're realizing it's an actual business strategy if you want to retain people, if you want to have the best talent. So, you know, but it's not going to go completely in that direction. So there's going to be some sweet spot of it working for each individual business.
You mentioned things like FaceTime earlier. Like I've participated in meetings remotely by phone, and that's generally terrible, right? On a conference mm-hmm. call or something like that. Nobody likes that, I don't think. But being able to see each other and maybe be a little more active and get that nuance and maybe just hear each other better. Is that making this more possible to do?
Definitely. I think it's definitely making it more possible to do because you feel like you're there. And it's such a savings for not only the company, but for the employee. You don't have to do all that traveling. That's something that we haven't talked about is all the savings that are afforded not just to a particular business, but to the economy, savings in gas, savings in CO2 emissions, savings in commute time, savings in real estate, you know, all of those things, not just for the business, but also for the employee.
On the cultural side of things, I mean, in so many realms in our lives, it's easier to stay in than go out. We can watch movies in the comfort of our own home a lot easier than we used to. The podcasts, we can stream music there. It's a lot easier to entertain ourselves at home and not get that human contact if we're not going to work either. Are we going to become this culture of recluses?
That's true. That's a danger. And that's why I think for many people, it just wouldn't work and they wouldn't be happy doing it because they need more social interaction, perhaps. But also, it may be that we're getting more social interaction in other ways, you know, neighborhoods, communities. And I think people are really craving that. There was an interesting study because I live in the country, there was an interesting study done in rural areas in Wisconsin. And one of the things that rural residents of Wisconsin wanted more of was social interaction and social kind of resources in their local communities.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Nick on the line in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Good afternoon. My question for the professor is this. Working in manufacturing, it's been instilled into my philosophy that going to Gemba, or the place where the work happens, is core to effective problem solving in manufacturing. And this is preached through the Toyota Way, Lean Manufacturing, Six Sigma, lots of manufacturing philosophies. How do we reconcile the working from home movement with the concept of going to Gemba and problem solving on the shop floor?
I think probably the way that that's going to be working is what I was talking about, the sweet spot, is that people are going to have to go into the office. Now, that's where the creativity part comes in, and that's where, as you said, the Six Sigma and all of the kind of traditional areas of business and performance in business happen. But it doesn't mean that at least every now and then you can't have a day working at home. Let's say that you have a big report to write up or something specific to work on. More people, I think when we're talking about working at home, that's more likely is that people that, like when Robin's talking about the people who work at home at least sometime, some of the time, 25% work at home like at least once a year. Only about 15% work at home at least one day a week. So you know, I think it's going to be more that we have the opportunity, even if it's just every now and then, to do some work at home.
Nick, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike now with us in Portage. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your situation, Mike?
I've had a couple of different telecommuting jobs. I'm a developer. One I had where everybody was a telecommuter. And let me just say that the organization is key in that because there was a point where my team forgot that I was on their team. We had monthly meetings and we touched base, and we had just got a new person was hired on as a manager, and he was kind of wrangling the cats. And so then we had a manager's meeting, and then the next month we had another one, and he goes, "Oh, wait, you're on our team too." And I had been emailing him every day, and he'd be communicating with me, but he had just forgotten, and I lost out on work because of it. Another time I worked, and some of us were telecommuting, others weren't. And that, again, is, a little difficult because the people who work together then in close proximity kind of have a tighter, closer relationship on the team. And those of us who were telecommuting kind of felt a bit left out. But then, like you guys said, the sweet spot, I had a job where I could work one or two days a week from home. And it was great because I could have a big project, take it home, work on it, get back into the office, and interact with people. And for me, I kind of really like that interaction. I think being able to communicate with somebody immediately versus having to, go on a video conference or something like that, I think that, to me anyways, is invaluable.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. So some good, the bad, and some being totally forgotten there.
And the ugly, right.
Right. So it does matter how you manage this kind of situation. I think we can learn from Mike's examples.
Yes, for sure. And I think he brings up a very important point about it being a combination and about being left out. You know, you have to have a situation where you don't feel like you're left out because you're not in the office. You know, it's very easy for clicks to happen in an office and very common. And, you know, if that's the situation in your workplace, you have to think twice about being off on your own.
Thanks for sharing your stories, Mike. Time for another caller. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say that I work from home. 100% of my job is done from home. What I do is I work for a call center. And when I started this job, we went into the headquarters for training, and we periodically had product meetings and things like that. But now, after you're hired, 100% of our meetings, our training, everything is done remotely. So you can work anywhere in the country and do this job. And our company has grown very rapidly, and we're always looking for people to do this. And I find that the company uses its employees to kind of recruit other employees. And I find when I talk to people about this job and I pitch it, this great work from home job, I'm very often met with skepticism. People think it must be a scam if you work from home.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. We're short on time, so I'm going to jump in. But there are work-at-home scams out there. Hopefully Laura's not in one of them.
Yes, for sure. And you do have to be careful about that.
Well, in our last few moments, Patty, where do you see this going? Are we going to see these numbers gradually keep going up, you think, when it comes to people working at home some of the time?
I think for sure, yes, that people will have the opportunity. I think it's as businesses really get to trust their workers, because there's a trust both ways, that goes both ways. I don't think it's going to take over the workplace, but it will certainly continue.
Patty, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
You're welcome.
And not working from home, I guess.
Right.
Patricia Mullins is a professor emerita in the School of Business at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. She was with us to talk about the growing number of American workers who are working from home at least some of the time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll meet a Wisconsin pastor who was working in Birmingham, Alabama at a key moment in the civil rights movement. He shares his story and his thoughts on racial inequalities in 21st century America. Economists get a lot of attention in the media, and they can hold a lot of sway in decision-making, but our guest says they get things wrong a lot. The author of The Economist's Hour joins the show. And we'll look at disagreements within the Democratic Party over how to raise money for next year's convention in Milwaukee. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, Governor Evers is pardoning four people for the first time in Wisconsin in 9 years. Kate and her guests look at the governor's power to pardon and why Governor Walker declined to use it during his time in office. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the role whistleblowers have played in American history, from the time of George Washington to the latest headlines. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.